Welcome to All Sides with Amy Jurevich on 89.7 NPR News. Donald Trump becomes the first person since Grover Cleveland to serve a second non-consecutive term as president. He broke with tradition in 2021 by not attending the inauguration of his successor and predecessor, President Biden. The ceremony has long been a symbol of the peaceful transfer of power in a democracy. We're talking about the history of presidential inaugurations this hour. And joining us is Paul Beck, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Ohio State University. Welcome, Paul.
Glad to be with you, Amy, and welcome to All Sides.
Thank you so much, Paul. I appreciate that. Also with us is Elizabeth Goldsmith, a Professor Emerita at Florida State University. She's an expert on first families and inaugural celebrations, including the inaugural luncheons and related activities. Elizabeth, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. I'm excited.
And also with us is Brian Ballow, an American historian and emeritus professor at the University of Virginia. He's also co-hosted the podcast and radio program Backstory with the American History Guys. Brian, thanks for being here.
Good to be here, Amy.
And now, before we get to Inauguration Day, while I have Paul Beck with us, I have to ask about some big political news that happened for Ohio on Friday. So Governor DeWine named his Lieutenant Governor John Husted to be Ohio's next U.S. Senator. Husted takes over the remainder of J.D. Vance's term, since Vance is becoming Vice President today. Paul Beck, what are your thoughts on Husted getting this important position?
Well, I very much expected that the appointment would go to Husted, who has been a loyal member of the DeWine administration, and was somebody who was expected to run for governor once DeWine is term limited out. Now, of course, he is not going to run for governor, or at least one wouldn't expect him to. He will run for the Senate seat that will be vacated by Vance in 2 years. I thought it was an obvious choice. The only thing that might have clouded that choice was whether Donald Trump himself would get involved and try to provide an endorsement of someone. He obviously did not get involved, or at least not openly so. And Husted will be probably the leading candidate for governor when we do the next election in 2026. It does, by the way, leave open who the new lieutenant governor is going to be, and I really haven't begun to give some serious thought to that, but there are obvious candidates, and that would position that particular person as probably the front runner for the governorship in 2026.
Great. And so we will talk more about John Husted's Senate appointment tomorrow. We're going to have a special Tuesday reporter roundtable. So now we'll get back to the news of today, the inauguration. It is bitterly cold today, and the events in Washington will now take place indoors. Brian, has that happened before, moving the inauguration?
Yeah. It actually always used to be held inside in the 19th century. So this is not unusual. There's always lots of symbolism around this. The story that I actually like about weather is about warm weather. When George H.W. Bush was replacing Ronald Reagan at his inauguration, looking through the window, he noticed that Nancy Reagan was wrapping up President Reagan in bundling him up, basically, on one of the warmest days for an inauguration. And Bush said to his aide, "Get me my coat," which he'd left in the car. And no time to get the coat, so the aide simply gave his overcoat to Bush so he could walk out with an overcoat and not upstage the former president for looking weak by being bundled up in a coat.
Oh, so if Reagan needs a coat, then I need a coat? Is that
exactly? And I'm not going to upstage him. Of course, Bush took the coat off immediately, but he walked out with that coat because he didn't want to upstage the former president.
And the idea of moving it indoors, did that surprise you? Did you think that maybe President Trump would be one of the ones who would try to show a toughness with the cold?
It didn't surprise me. There's a lot of discussion, and I defer to my political scientist colleague on this, Paul. There was a lot of discussion about crowd size, not surprising, given Trump's previous inauguration. I have no idea why they did it. Having walked to your studio in 6-degree weather, I think it makes a lot of sense to move it inside.
Elizabeth, would you like to add about the idea of moving it inside? What are your thoughts on having inauguration events inside versus outside?
Well, I think it makes a lot of sense, especially for their second go round. And right after the oath, they turn around and go to the luncheon, which is held in the Capitol. So efficiency wise, it makes sense. And then to the parade.
Which the parade is now going to be inside, too. It's going to be inside an arena in Washington, D.C.
OK, they keep changing every few minutes.
Oh, so yeah. Well, maybe
it's traditional, and then there's what's sort of happening.
Yeah. Paul Beck, what are your thoughts on politically a president showing whether he can stand the cold and have all of his supporters stand in the cold versus going inside?
Well, of course, it is very cold, and there's a big wind chill factor as well to factor in to that. One can understand them wanting to move the celebration inside. I think that it's probably something that Trump didn't prefer to do. He likes celebration. He likes the celebration of his reelection as president in particular. So I think that he was probably one of the doubters about doing that. I think it's an important move, by the way. You don't want people standing out in the cold freezing. Particularly in a cold day like it is in Washington, D.C., or here in Columbus, for that matter. I think it's even a little bit colder here than it is in D.C. We need to remember that part of the inauguration is celebratory. It's where the winners of the election are able to celebrate their victory. People come to Washington wanting to celebrate that victory. Many of them, of course, invited by the president-elect in this case, Donald Trump, but many of them just followers of his, wanting to bask in the quote warm and quote glow of inauguration. But it also is a transfer of power, a very important transfer of power, where once he is inaugurated, President Trump will assume the powers of the president, taking them from Joe Biden. And then there are a series of things that he has expected us to want from him in terms of executive orders and other moves to define that administration as his.
Yeah, we will talk about the executive orders later in the hour. But first, I wanted to talk about the last inauguration was pretty unprecedented in many respects. The nation was still in the grips of the pandemic. We were fresh off the heels of the January 6th attack at the Capitol. And Donald Trump chose not to attend the event. Do you feel like, Brian, do you feel like January 20th, 2021 was truly unprecedented, looking back at history?
Well, it wasn't literally unprecedented because very early in the Republic, John Adams didn't attend Thomas Jefferson's inauguration. And things were really, what you did back then were very important because they, of course, set precedent. Adams claimed that it wasn't intentional. In fact, they had exchanged some warm letters shortly before that. He wanted to get back home. Didn't seem like that big a deal. But in terms of not attending inaugurations, it has been done before.
And Elizabeth, you're an expert on first families. You've studied many inaugurations. Have you seen a time besides what Brian just mentioned, maybe in more recent times, where a president does not attend the next president's inauguration?
Well, not that so much, but who drives them? Yeah, to the Capitol. They used to have the lunch at the White House in Truman era. So everything changed after Eisenhower on. So that's been the tradition to have more at the Capitol and less at the White House during Inauguration Day.
There were some pretty icy drives, though, right, Elizabeth? I mean, apparently.
Yeah, icy drives.
Eisenhower and Truman drove together, but didn't talk to each other.
Yeah, didn't talk. Or what do they talk about? Yeah.
When you said icy drives, I was thinking of the cold weather. They slipped on ice. That's funny.
Different kind of icy.
Okay, so there's
both icy within the car and outside the car, I suppose.
Yeah, and I guess, I think things keep going back and forth about the parade, but my understanding is that the parade later today will be inside. It'll be inside an arena. So I guess we missed that whole image of a president getting out of the car and waving to the crowd. Elizabeth, that's an image you can remember from a lot of inaugurations, right?
Right. Well, President Carter was the last one who skipped the luncheon and said, let's get the parade going. So he went right from the oath and the address to the walking to the White House. So he had his own way. There's a joint committee that really forms all this, but then they have some say-so about menus and different kinds of things. I hope that answers your question. It's just been so irregular, you know, because of the weather.
Irregular is the new normal right now, right?
I think so. And maybe for 4 years.
Perhaps. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about inaugurations past and present with Paul Beck, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Ohio State University, Elizabeth Goldsmith, a Professor Emerita at Florida State University, and Brian Ballow, an American historian and Emeritus Professor at the University of Virginia. So, Brian, let's go back for some of the earlier inaugurations. They used to take place in March. When was it moved to January?
It was moved to January as a result of the 20th Amendment, if I'm not mistaken, in the middle of the 1930s. And it was in many ways a symbol of how important the presidency was becoming. The fact that you really couldn't afford to wait that many months after the election. And that was combined, of course, with the ease of transportation. You know, back in the day, it took a long time to get to Washington. Roads were not great, all of that kind of thing.
And Paul Beck, could you imagine nowadays thinking about the way politics is today? Could you imagine waiting till March to actually be sworn in?
I think it would have been horrible. The media, people like you, Amy, and maybe us as guests on various shows, would run out of things to talk about if we had to wait for 3 more months before the inauguration itself. And I think that Brian put his finger on one of the important things to realize, and that was that the presidency has become so much more important for the country. And travel is a real condition there. It would have been hard for candidates who had won the presidency to travel from their home, I think, of Lincoln in Illinois, for instance, to Washington, D.C., and to get there by early January so that he could prepare for that particular inauguration. The other thing, by the way, that we need not miss about all of this is another change, an important change in tradition. In the past, the inauguration largely was funded by the government. Right now, the inauguration is going to be funded, or at least many of the activities surrounding the inauguration, by fundraising that has taken place, in this case, by Donald Trump and his newly elected administration. We're talking about millions and millions of dollars that are going to go into an inauguration fund that will not be spent on the inauguration, but will be spent, I think, to pave the way for continued Republican administration in 2026 and 2028 when we have another presidential election. And that's relatively new. Recent presidents have used the inaugural as a way to fund their campaigns and to fund their activities politically, but not to the extent that Trump has. And this is very much unprecedented.
Yeah, Brian, would you like to add anything about the money? I know probably putting on all these parties is expensive, but he's definitely raised more than needed.
All I'll say, and this is implied in what Paul said, it gets bigger and bigger and bigger with each, more and more expensive with each inauguration. You know, for Roosevelt's last inaugural lunch, Roosevelt wanted chicken a la king, basically, creamy chicken. And Eleanor Roosevelt put the kibosh on that. It was still during World War II. People were sacrificing their lives, of course, but they were also not eating lots of foods that were going to the troops. So they had chicken salad.
Hmm. Yeah, Elizabeth, you were nodding there. So can you talk a little bit about the money spent, the lavishness of some of these events, and or the lack thereof?
Oh, well, I think they're getting more lavish. That's a pretty good comment, and bigger. Let's talk for a minute about what's going on in the White House during the inaugural. Well, the staff loves it when they have a long time at the Capitol because it gets them more time to get the house ready, right down to the toothbrushes. So the old president leaves and, you know, everything's out. They've been doing this for weeks, but not the detail. And then they've got just a few hours to get the sheets and everything done the way the new president wants it. They also move the portraits around. So you'll have more Republican portraits closer to some of the main rooms. They'll redo the Oval Office every time. So there's a lot of things happening in these 4 or 5 hours that are behind the scenes, and exciting for them too.
You know, Amy, you mentioned that Trump is the first president since Grover Cleveland to not be renominated and then return 4 years later. And supposedly, Grover Cleveland's wife said when they were leaving the White House for the first time, "Don't move anything around. We'll be back."
Oh,
turned out she was right.
She was right. Mm-hmm. Wonder if Melania said something similar. Mm-hmm. Well, we're going to continue to talk about the presidential inauguration when All Sides continues. This is 89.7 NPR News. We'll be back after this break.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. It's Inauguration Day, and we've convened a panel of historians and political scientists to talk about the history and protocols surrounding the event. Still with us is Paul Beck, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Ohio State University. Thanks again for being here, Paul.
Good to be with you, Amy.
And Elizabeth Goldsmith, Professor Emerita at Florida State University. She's an expert on first families and inaugural celebrations, including the inaugural luncheon and related activities. Elizabeth, thanks again for joining us.
Okay, thanks, Amy.
And Brian Ballow, an American historian and emeritus professor at the University of Virginia. He also co-hosted the radio program Backstory with the American History Guys. So Inauguration Day always follows a specific timeline, and it's altered a little bit, I feel like, today because of the cold. Elizabeth, what is your favorite part of the inauguration timeline, regardless of who the president is? What do you always look forward to?
Well, I started studying the luncheon just because nobody else had. I couldn't find any information. It's not usually televised. They try to make it more private with members of Congress. And the menu sometimes reflects a theme of the United States or of the president or vice president. So last time they had steak, it was catered with President Trump. And we'll see what they do this time. That's his favorite. So I'm guessing that again. So there's three courses catered, have to get it out in 1 hour. So that's really tight. And then the parade starts and then dinner at the White House, usually with family and friends.
Paul Beck, do you have a favorite part of Inauguration Day?
Well, the thing I look for the most is the inaugural speech itself. Mm-hmm. This is where the president-elect sets his agenda for the future. Trump has talked already a lot about what that agenda is going to be. It will be interesting to see how much of what he has already said will work its way into the inaugural speech itself. We all remember his inaugural speech when he was first elected as president, it was a really vitriolic speech. American carnage is what it's being referred to. Whether he will repeat that kind of theme or adopt a more unifying sort of thing will be interesting to see. One doesn't expect that, given what he has said during the campaign. On the other hand, if anything, Trump surprises. It'll be interesting to see if he actually surprises us with his inaugural speech in 2025.
Probably two of the most memorable inaugural speeches were those given by Franklin D. Roosevelt.
So first of all, let me assert my firm belief that the only thing we have to fear is fear itself.
And John F. Kennedy.
Ask not what your country can do for you. Ask what you can do for your country.
Brian, do you recall other speeches that have stood out to you over time?
I'm glad you didn't ask if I could recall Roosevelt's speech. That's very kind of you. I don't recall them. I've certainly read about them. Certainly Lincoln's, both Lincoln's speeches. They gave us phrases like mystic chords of memory. They gave us phrases like our better angels. They gave us a language that you could hear repeated in major political speeches for the next century or so. I actually think the most important inauguration was George Washington's, because everything that he did, and the speech was pretty short, by the way, everything he did set a precedent. He literally was shaking when he gave the first inaugural speech, because he was so worried that he might do something that could cripple this new republic. And we have to remember, the republic was very weak. The British Empire was a pretty strong enemy to have. And so everything that Washington did was scrutinized. Should he shake hands or not shake hands? Should he walk or take his carriage? How should he dress? He agonized over how to dress. He wore a very plain American homespun suit, but his shoes were a bit of a tell. He had diamond buckles. So the greatest fear was the fear of monarchy. And I think it's worth all of us pondering the contrast between George Washington turning himself into a pretzel to not appear to like a monarch, and Donald Trump, who kind of likes the monarchical look, if you will.
Paul Beck, did you want to add something?
Well, just a couple of things. One is that we need to remember that George Washington himself was not a polished public speaker. That had not been his role during the war, and certainly had not been his role in politics, such as his involvement had been over time. The other thing to bear in mind is that, of course, this was a speech that was given, the inauguration speech, to the crowd of people who were assembled there, but not broadcast nationwide. Today, every television network, as far as I can tell, is going to carry that speech live. There isn't much other programming, although with cable now you can always find other programming. But there's not going to be much other programming, at least on the major stations. And so the focus is going to be on the inaugural speech as well, in a way that, of course, couldn't have been well over 200 years ago. The other thing that I wanted to remember is, you know, thinking about the March inauguration in the past, before the change in the 1930s. Is that when Lincoln was elected in 1860, there was a very real threat that he may not get to Washington alive. And there was all kinds of conspiracy in the air at the time. He was sneaked into Washington, basically, without any kind of advertisement about how he was going to come to Washington, very well protected there. It again was a dangerous time as the nation was poised on what became the Civil War, of course, soon after his inauguration. We're not seeing that today, although 2001, I guess, is probably, excuse me, 2005 is something that we remember as something that was very, very bloody and controversial. And the rivalry was really sharp during that particular inauguration.
And Brian, what did you want to add?
I just wanted to double down on a point that Paul made about how these inaugural speeches are received. For much of the 19th century, it was the written speech, the published speech that was circulated in newspapers and read communally in many ways at pubs and that kind of thing. It really wasn't until 1925 that we had the first radio broadcast of a speech by Calvin Coolidge. So our listeners should remember, first of all, that's a shout out for radio. Let's hear it for radio. But when we talk about these speeches and how they're received, I wanted to emphasize Paul's point. They were received by relatively small audiences and certainly not broadcast in any way, shape, or form.
And Elizabeth, both Brian and Paul both mentioned the length of the speech. If I remember correctly, Donald Trump's speech was fairly short for Donald Trump back in 2017. I think it was maybe 17 or 18 minutes. Do you think that because he's inside, maybe he's going to speak longer because it's not as cold? Or do you think that they're going to try to hold him to a time because you said the luncheon has to start on time?
I think they'll hold him to a time. And the only really long one was Harrison, over an hour. And I think with television and media and radio and everything, maybe we don't need that. I did want to say that John Kennedy was the last president to wear a black top hat to the inauguration. Mm-hmm. So he dressed up. But then LBJ, that wasn't his thing. So that was the change away from those top hats you can picture from old movies.
Paul Beck, what do you think about the length of the speech? Donald Trump is known for his lengthy campaign speeches. He's known for speaking for over an hour and a half sometimes. Do you think he'll talk for a long time today?
Well, it'll be interesting to see. Yeah, he is somebody who is hard to control in terms of how long his speeches are going to be or what their content is, for that matter. And we'll see what happens. He is constrained, as Elizabeth has pointed out, by the presidential lunch that takes place soon thereafter in a very tight schedule for the rest of the afternoon. And so there will be constraints on that. But again, nobody really constrains him. He will, I think, do what he wants to do. And may get carried away as well in his speech. It's, I think he did in the American Carnage speech from 8 years ago.
This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News. We're talking about inaugurations past and present. We have a panel of emeriti professors, if that's how you pluralize emeriti. Paul Beck is with us from Ohio State University, Elizabeth Goldsmith from Florida State University, and Brian Ballow of the University of Virginia. And Brian, I'm sorry, could we talk for a minute about the vice president? So the vice president is sworn in first. Has there been any significant things you remember about the vice president being sworn in? For Ohio, it's Ohio's own J.D. Vance getting sworn in now.
Yeah. Again, remember, I'm not that old, Amy, but read about, yes, I mean, the most infamous swearing in. And by the way, they used to give speeches also.
The vice president used to give a speech?
The vice president used to give speeches.
Oh, that would really delay the lunch, huh?
Exactly. Well, they weren't on a TV schedule back in the 19th century. And Andrew Johnson gave a speech to Congress that just rambled on so much so that there are two interpretations. Either he was drunk, which was a possibility, or he was ill and the medicine that he was taking had an effect upon him. Of course, they could be one and the same thing. A lot of these medicines had a lot of liquor in them.
Wait, which vice president was this?
Andrew Johnson.
Okay, got
it. So either way, Lincoln is sitting there. This is Lincoln's second inauguration, and everybody was embarrassed. And the speech literally stopped. He just ran out of gas and sat down. So that was a pretty memorable vice presidential speech.
Paul Beck, do you want to add anything about vice presidential speeches?
I really don't have anything to add. Of course, I wasn't around when Andrew Johnson did.
Oh, come on, Paul.
So I don't have direct information on that, although, like Brian, I've read about some of these talks in the past.
Elizabeth, the vice president and the president both always pick someone to hold the Bible. That's always a big symbol of which Bible they're using, who's holding it. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, they've held the Bible since George Washington, so that's a tradition, and they've never missed. That's what they do. There's been 7 inaugurations that weren't held in Washington because of assassinations or illness or, you know, some disaster. So what we're seeing today is what usually happens, but there's been a past, and everybody remembers, or a lot of people remember, Kennedy and LBJ on an airplane being given the oath of office after his assassination, meaning Kennedy. So there's so much. We haven't talked about the balls tonight, so that'll be an opportunity for supporters. And they usually start at 9 o'clock in the big hotels in Washington, D.C.
Well, yeah, I want to get into the balls. So it's just about time to take a break. So why don't we hold that for the next segment? We are going to talk about all those inaugural balls, all the dancing, all the music that we've gotten used to in recent years seeing on TV. This is All Sides on 89.7 NPR News, and we'll continue our discussion of the presidential inauguration in just a moment.
We could all use a little help navigating the news these days. The Consider This podcast wants to give you a hand. 6 days a week, we'll help you make sense of the day's biggest news story and what it means for you in less than 15 minutes. Listen now to the Consider This podcast from NPR.
You're listening to All Sides. I'm your host, Amy Jurevich. We're talking about the history and ceremony surrounding Inauguration Day. Still with us, Paul Beck, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Ohio State University, Elizabeth Goldsmith, Professor Emerita at Florida State University, and Brian Ballow, an American historian and Emeritus Professor at the University of Virginia. So, Elizabeth, as we went to the break, you mentioned inaugural balls. So all of the day's events seem to culminate with this big, beautiful ball that will happen tonight. And in recent years, we see it on TV. We watch the president and the first lady dance. When did all of this ceremony with the balls begin?
Well, pretty much from the beginning. They've done it if they're in Washington, D.C. The big hotels are ready for it. I've been to the ballroom at Mayflower Hotel, where they hold them every year. The dress is important that she wears, the First Lady, and that will go to the Smithsonian in the First Lady's exhibit, and I've helped with that. It's changed over the years. They rotate the dresses and the public interest in them. But what she wears tonight, right now, last I saw, she had a black hat and black outfit on, and before it was powder blue. So and she's here from day one. So it's a different approach, not just with President Trump, but also with her, I think, to watch. And I've been to parties at the White House and receptions for 30 years, so I can compare firsthand experience as well. And the Trump party he put on in 2019 was extraordinary, with a band in the backyard playing, a band inside playing. The house pretty much opened up, and the whole cabinet, or nearly the whole cabinet, there. So it was very formal, very traditional, very lively. And I think he's good at that sort of thing. And Mrs. Trump as well.
Besides Trump's first inauguration, is there any other ball that stands out to you? Any other dress or event that happened that was significant?
Well, at one point, Mrs. Carter was just wearing her gown from being the governor's wife. She said, "Why get a new dress?" But now, you got to say, that's a different approach, right? And that was in the Smithsonian. And that was light blue, and it was attractive, but it was a used dress she'd worn before.
I can remember when Barack Obama's inauguration, having him and Michelle dancing, and the I think Beyonce sang "At Last," and that was a big surprise for everyone that Beyonce was there. Was that significant?
Oh yeah, who the entertainers are, and of course most of them have figured out to try to be on board and be part of things. So it's a more comfortable level, a more festive level than I think before the election.
Brian, you want to add about balls?
Yeah, the most exceptional balls are rarely mentioned, and those are the ones held by Franklin D. Roosevelt, because he's in a wheelchair. And so ball obviously implies dancing, as Elizabeth was referring to. And rather than balls, Roosevelt held inaugural concerts. So there would be no dancing.
And well, you had mentioned earlier that they were trying not to be too lavish or spend too much money. So is that did Franklin D. Roosevelt also do it? Were the concerts lavish?
I don't think this was a matter of economy, although I don't think they cost all that much. You have to remember, for much of Roosevelt's tenure, a long one, we were in the midst of the Great Depression, and then we were fighting World War II. So maybe economy had something to do with it. But this is mainly they didn't want to humiliate a president who was in a wheelchair.
And Elizabeth, we mentioned much earlier in the show that Donald Trump did not attend President Biden's inauguration. There's a lot being made of the fact that Michelle Obama is not attending today. Have you heard that talk? Do you think, does it matter that a former first lady has chosen not to attend?
Well, I think it's her decision. I like the way the Bidens are handling it. Very eloquent, I would say. Elegant. And the Kennedys were very elegant. So people are different. Mrs. Biden always looks good in light blue. And she's wearing light blue again. So blue, she also would say in a speech that I heard, she's the only first lady who had a full-time paid job while her husband was president. And that's being a college professor. So when I talked to her a few years ago, that's how we related, talking about what it's like to be a college professor and her role, and she said, it's hard, but I could see an enthusiasm in her. That's really nice. So they all have their own styles, and some are more comfortable dancing than others as well.
I can imagine. So this morning, before we got on the air today, I was watching TV, and I saw that the Bidens hosted President Trump and Melania for a tea. And so that didn't happen 4 years ago because Trump didn't attend. So there was no tea that happened 4 years ago. But did you, the tea is also a tradition?
Yeah, that's a tradition. And then get in the car and go to the Capitol. And, you know, sort of look around the house one more time, because once they're gone, you don't go back unless you're invited. You can't say, can I see the old house? No. Same with me. I have to be invited. You don't invite yourself. So I was really surprised by that. The Trump party, they had 80 descendants of first families, and most of them said they had never been back in the house since they were kids or grown adults.
And Paul Beck, can you talk a little bit about the politics of this? Like, whenever you heard that Michelle Obama wasn't attending, what do you think of that from a political standpoint?
Yeah, I don't really think it matters much. I guess it gives them something to talk about, or gives us something to talk about. On the other hand, she is not the immediate first lady. She goes back a few years. It's really, I think, as Elizabeth put it, it's really up to her to decide whether she wants to attend or not. She could feel that it wouldn't have been particularly pleasant to be there. So as I, come to the bottom line, I don't think it matters. Now, the politics obviously does matter. The contrast between the 2021 inauguration and the 2025 inauguration is about as great a contrast as you could ever imagine. Because in 2021, we still had a candidate who was not willing to accept the outcome of the election, not willing to accept the certification, and in fact had really supported his supporters invading the White House in contestation of that election. We don't have any of that in 2025. And the difference there, of course, is that the outgoing administration has decided that they're not going to contest the result going to allow a transition to be smooth.
Yeah, Brian, I wanted to talk to you about the idea of the larger meaning of an inauguration, right? It's the peaceful transfer of power. Can you talk a bit about the larger meaning?
I think that especially in democracies, we as a nation are held together by traditions and ceremonies, going back to the 4th of July, for instance. And so I think the inauguration is one of those traditions. What really strikes me about the actual inaugural speeches is, for all they're supposed to be about incoming and new, almost always they're backwards looking. They want to connect with history. They want to connect this president with the long history of the United States. Even the inauguration of Jefferson Davis, the president of the Confederate States of America, Jefferson Davis talked about Washington, George Washington. Mm. He talked about the Confederacy being true to the real nation, which of course did have slavery. And so inaugural speeches often connect us with the past. The irony is many presidents have given farewell speeches. There Eisenhower warned of the military-industrial complex. Joe Biden just warned us about an emerging oligarchy. The irony is a lot of farewell speeches are not about the past. They're about warning about the future. So we think of inaugurations as the beginning. In fact, they look backwards. We think of farewells as the end. Yet they're really often looking forward. So I think that's one of the great anomalies of these traditions.
And Paul Beck, I can imagine that in Donald Trump's speech today, he will look back, but probably only at Biden. Do you think he'll go back further than that? Because then it goes to him.
Well, he has looked back further than that. He has continued to attack Hillary Clinton and to talk about the deep state that was, of course, put in place in his view long before the Biden administration had taken office. So I think there will be some of that. We've heard some of that during the campaign itself. I think he can't stay away from that. He is somebody who has experienced a very deep sense of victimization and has talked, at least during the campaign, about retribution for that victimization. Again, it'll be interesting to see how much of that works its way into the inaugural speech that's going to be performed or presented today.
Yeah, and Paul Beck, we didn't mention it at the very beginning, but early this morning, President Biden issued some preemptive pardons on different people who were involved in the investigation into the January 6th attack. Have you heard of, in your experience, have there been preemptive pardons in his last few hours in office?
Well, nothing to this degree. Of course, we have not had an incoming president who has attacked many of the top people in the administration of his predecessor. And so one can understand why Biden would feel a need to protect both the committees that investigated the Trump campaign and the period after the confirmation of the election of 2020. We can understand why Biden wanted to do that, whether the people who have been pardoned actually wanted that or asked for that themselves. We don't know. We will probably find out over time, but it's been interesting to see this. And again, this is unprecedented. Previous presidents have often pardoned people or commuted sentences of people who were in prison for drug offenses, fairly minor kinds of things. But nobody has gone to the point except for Biden, you know, again today and in recent days, of pardoning people who were at the top echelons of the administration.
Brian, in your studies of history, have you had any experience with an outgoing president doing X in his last 2 hours before he leaves?
There's certainly no equivalent that I know of to preemptive pardons. I just want to say, as a historian, it's an indication of the recent trend towards the amplification and expansion of presidential powers. Trump is all about the unified executive branch and his ability to control every aspect of that executive branch. And I think, and of course, there's the Supreme Court decision basically immunizing presidents against acts that they take that might be illegal while they are the president. And I think Joe Biden decided, hey, that sounds pretty good to me. I'm going to use some of that expansion of presidential power and pardon people preemptively.
Now, before we end, I wanted to bring up just one thing. I guess, Paul Beck, since you're from Ohio State, and Brian, you live here in Ohio, J.D. Vance made a joke that he was going to skip the inauguration so that he could be in Atlanta tonight to watch Ohio State's football team play in the national championship. He was obviously joking, but it did make me chuckle. I suppose he could, though, skip the inaugural ball, and he'd make it to the game on time, right?
Well, he'll probably tape it and watch it afterwards, of course, depending upon the result itself. But we expect Ohio State fans to be more loyal to the Buckeyes than to whoever happens to be elected as president. And so I think that Vance, in a jocular fashion, has followed that expectation.
Elizabeth, has anyone ever skipped an inaugural ball for a football game?
Not that I know of. But anything can happen, especially the last few days.
Do you expect to see J.D. Vance and his wife dancing tonight as well? Normally, the focus is on the president and the first lady.
Right. I don't know. You know, Vance is only 40 years old. We got one of the youngest vice presidents and his wife, and could be they like it. I think of the balls sort of like weddings. And some people enjoy that part, and some people it's not their thing. So we'll find out. But my guess is he was joking around, and he'll be at the balls. And they go to several. The car drops them off. They do 5 minutes, then they go to the next one. They don't stay.
How many balls are there tonight?
I don't know, because everything keeps changing. But 5 to 8's not unusual. So we'll see.
All right, Brian, we have 30 seconds remaining. I'll give you the last word.
Well, I think we're all waiting to hear what incoming President Trump has to say. And I will admit that I was really surprised because last time for his inauguration, almost all presidents talk about coming together, even after very contentious races. Thomas Jefferson set the model for that. And I really expected Trump to say, let's come together, let's heal. He obviously didn't in his first inaugural speech. I really do very much hope for the country that he returns to tradition of calling for healing in the nation coming together.
I want to say thank you to our guests this hour. Paul Beck, Professor Emeritus of Political Science at Ohio State University. Paul, thank you so much for joining us.
Good to be here, Amy.
Elizabeth Goldsmith, Professor Emerita at Florida State University. Thank you for your time, Elizabeth.
Okay, it's been great, Amy. Thank you.
And Brian Ballow, an American historian and emeritus professor at the University of Virginia. Thank you so much for being with us.
I learned a lot.
Thank you for joining us, listeners. And in just a moment, we're going to be joining live special coverage from NPR of the inauguration. The coverage continues on 89.7 NPR News, and stay with us all day for continuing coverage of the events of the day. This is 89.7 NPR News.